You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today we're in Carson. The sun's going down early this time of year, and wait a minute. Is that what I think it is? Yeah, they're back. Oh, you know that sound. You've probably seen our wild neighbors out prowling at night all across the region. We're talking about coyotes, of course. Here in Carson, people say they're seeing more coyotes than ever, and not just during the hours between dusk and dawn, when they usually roam, and not just in Carson either. Coyotes have been adapting to an urban life, and they've become increasingly tolerant and less afraid, or even respectful, of their two-legged neighbors, i.e. us. Joining us to talk about it is Amy Moriarty, a resident of Carson. She's been seeing a lot of coyotes in her neighborhood. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Neve Quinn is a researcher with the University of California's Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources, who works on human and wildlife interactions. Welcome, Neve.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Amy, I'm going to start with you. You took that recording that we just heard, you know, all the yipping and crying of the coyotes. They were very close to your home, weren't they?
Yes. I've had some close interactions. I live very close. My house, the front of my house, is across from a wilderness marsh. Our mobile home park is built around this marsh. And so any time of the day or night, if I'm outside, I can see them pop up just several feet away from me. And then I also have to listen to terrible noises at night, and a lot of my neighbors are just really, really afraid that they have small pets. You know, even keeping them outdoors, if they take them for a walk, they never know if a coyote's going to pop up. So a lot of people just feel really terrified that they just got to stay inside with their pets.
How long have you lived in that area?
About 35 years.
So since about the mid-1980s.
Exactly.
Has it gotten worse over the years? Have you noticed it getting much worse?
Definitely, because, well, we've only had the coyotes, I believe, since about 2012. But we had one incident years ago where a coyote right around noon, ran up the steps, hopped a baby gate, got a dog in its mouth, and then went back in. And neighbors are watching the whole thing. They saw it. So they have become more aggressive as far as if they see animals outside.
And how concerned are you? Are you fearful for your pets or your neighbor's pets? Are you fearful for your own safety?
Mainly I have one pet that was a stray pet that I adopted. So I'm in the process of keeping it in more and more. But some of my neighbors are just really terrified because they, even if they have, like, you know, their husband or a tall man walking the small dogs, the coyotes will still come up onto them and look at them, and then they have to scare them off. So, you know, everybody's really afraid because, you know, even if your pet accidentally gets out, that's probably it.
Neve, I want to bring you in. The California Department of Fish and Wildlife estimates that there are somewhere between 250,000 and 750,000 coyotes all up and down the state. So you've been tracking them here in LA County for the past couple of years. We think of them as canines that live in the wilderness, and, you know, they cross the wildland-urban interface from time to time. But now it seems like they're just in neighborhoods. Is that what you're seeing too? And what is the data telling you?
Well, we're seeing them pretty much everywhere where we looked for them in Los Angeles County. And I'm working with the LA County Department of Ag and the Ag Commissioner's Department. And we are working together, and we've trapped 20 coyotes so far from, you know, Santa Monica to, you know, up to Glendale and Burbank, across to La Verne, down into Hacienda Heights, Diamond Bar, into Lakewood. And we're seeing coyotes not just in this urban, you know, rural interface. We're seeing them in fairly urban areas, you know, very densely populated urban areas, where there isn't that much open space as well.
You said trap.
Yes.
So when you trap a coyote, what do you do with the coyote? Do you just release them into the wild again?
So when we trap a coyote, we put a GPS collar on it. And so we catch the coyote, we give it an ear tag, and we give it a collar, and then we let it go again. And then we're able to track its movements all around the place. And it's interesting because Some of them have really, really small home ranges. So we have a coyote that might have a home range that's less than a half a mile squared, whereas we have another coyote that could have a home range that is nearly the length of 10 miles.
How do they operate differently than mountain lions? Like a P-22, right? We know that they're in Griffith Park or some of the canyons and mountains of, off the 101 freeway, things like that. Do you see coyotes sort of acting the same way?
So coyotes are definitely not like mountain lions. They're very, very different, and they use the space very, very differently, thankfully, because most of us don't want to be playing golf and having to deal with a mountain lion, or none of us really want to be out on a stroll and encountering a mountain lion. So coyotes can exist in very small habitat patches, which is different than mountain lions. Mountain lions need huge amounts of green space. Mountain lions, they need deer as well to eat generally. Although they do eat quite a lot of coyotes as well. And so, but coyotes can, they don't need that much green space. So our data is showing that they can exist in very densely populated urban areas that have like small little patches of green space, so little tiny parks, even schools. They're traveling along flood control channels, railway lines, even the sides of freeways. They're pretty much getting around nearly like we get around.
And certainly people who are walking their dogs, right? I mean, small pets, the coyotes we know will attack small pets, correct?
Well, we know from our research in Southern California that cats are one of the most preferred mammalian prey items for coyotes. So cats, rats, and rabbits, they will eat a good amount of. And so, the best way to protect your cat is to keep it inside. And that also has, good environmental consequences as well, because then your cat's not, killing other wildlife. So that's helpful too. And then if your dog is on a leash, it's generally well protected, although we do have sometimes times when dogs that are on leash are attacked by coyotes. But the best thing you can do is make sure you're aware of your surroundings, and especially if you have a small dog on a leash, if you see a coyote, the best thing you can do is actually pick it up.
Neve, what would you tell Amy to do to make sure that she could keep the coyotes away, especially with that marsh, that natural area right by her house and in that neighborhood?
It seems like right now that the coyotes in your marsh are kind of doing what coyotes do. They eat, they roam around looking for food, and it sounds like when you scared them, right, that they ran away, correct?
Sometimes they just move a little bit. Kind of look at you. They're kind of getting more and more adapted, where sometimes residents have told me they've tried to make a noise and they just kind of look at you.
Yeah, I think for hazing, what's really recommended, and as a caveat to that, we don't actually know if hazing works. So hazing is the kind of the practice where you try and make the coyote very uncomfortable, and you make a lot of noise, you wave your arms, you make yourself look big, and the coyote is supposed to run away. Now, what you said, Amy, where they kind of turn around and they're like, "Huh, me?" You kind of have to keep going. And so you're essentially just making it really uncomfortable for them to be in the area. You're not trying to hurt them, you're not harassing them. It's called hazing. Whether or not it works or not is a totally different story. We just don't know. But it's kind of all we have for right now.
I also want to bring in Jim Hartman from the LA County Agricultural Commissioner's Office. They're the ones who take calls about coyote issues all across greater LA. Jim, welcome to you. What kinds of calls are you getting, and have they increased in recent years?
Well, hi, Steve. It's good to be here. We take a number of, we take calls from the whole spectrum. I mean, things from folks that have just seen a coyote and just want to report it to someone to let us know, to up to situations where folks have lost pets. We do track our calls, and it does seem over the years we seem to be getting a fair amount of additional calls. Also, too, I think part of it is that, and particularly with the pandemic, with more people being at home, more people are aware of coyotes, I think, than they have been in the past.
Some cities, Jim, have coyote management protocols that are in place. In Torrance, not too far away from Carson, there's a 5-month program to trap and euthanize coyotes between, I guess this is between the winter months of, October into March. before the breeding season. Rancho Palos Verdes is considering hiring a private trapper. Is the county involved in anything like that? I mean, do these kinds of measures even work?
The county does do, so you know, I have six biologists, including myself, who go out and engage with the public for the purposes of helping them with their wildlife conflict issues, coyotes probably being our number one mammal that we have to deal with. And we do an awful lot of education because, you know, a lot of the issues that are brought forward, you know, we have kind of a hand in creating those situations. For instance, either inadvertently feeding coyotes or intentionally feeding coyotes. And so, therefore, we make it very easy for them to live and be our neighbors. So we, and of course, our whole situation, because coyotes are very, very tolerant of our presence. I mean, there was a reason why their distant cousins became our, you know, our best friends thousands of years ago. Hmm. It allows them to be a part of our lives, and we create situations with lots of, you know, fruit on the ground and lots of water, whether water features or we feed birds or things like that that attract things that they will feed on as well. So we create a really great environment for them to thrive in. And again, there's very, very little to limit their population other than, like I say, cars and disease. So a lot of it is trying to bring awareness to the public of these animals and what we can do to try to prevent them becoming habituated and being so comfortable that they literally lose their fear of us and create more problems for us. This is a serious topic, but it's something that, you know, can be discussed and it shouldn't be out of fear, right? With education and knowledge, we shouldn't be afraid of these animals.
Jim Hartman, L.A. County Deputy Agricultural Commissioner. Neve Quinn, researcher at UCAL's Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources. And Amy Moriarty, who lives in Carson. Thanks for the coyote talk today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And by the way, we'll have links to where you can track coyotes, report them in your neighborhood, even get tips on how to deal with them at our website. And what about you? Do you have a coyote story to share? Do you have a question about coyotes? We are all ears. Well, and eyes, too. KCRW.com/AskGreaterLA. KCRW.com/AskGreaterLA. Coming up, she played a tough New York City cop on TV in the 80s. In reality, she started off as a debutante and grew up in the shadows of Hollywood right here in L.A.
Apparently, there are still many things about me that others think need fixing. I'm 78 years old now. F*** 'em.
Sharon Gless on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you grew up in the 80s and watched CBS on Monday night, she played a tough detective with her co-star Tyne Daly at a police precinct in New York City. She replaced Lynn Redgrave in a sitcom called House Calls. It was set at a hospital in San Francisco. You may know her as the mother of a gay son on the popular Showtime program Queer as Folk, set in Pittsburgh.
Hi, boys. Getting any tonight? I haven't seen you around here before.
He's new.
And cute. Every guy in the place has his eye on you tonight, sweetheart.
Can we order?
Shoot. You gotta keep your strength up, sunshine. You can't cruise all night on an empty stomach.
Sharon Gless, though, isn't waitress or hospital administrator or cop. She is all L.A., having grown up here in various parts of town, getting into show business here, and apparently ruffling a few feathers all along the way. And she's out with a new book called Apparently There Were Complaints, a memoir. Sharon Glass, welcome to you.
Thank you, Steve.
First of all, who's complaining about you?
Who isn't? What page are you on?
Yeah, the book is full of complaints from your agent, the doctor.
I know. My grandmother, I get it.
This was Grimmy, right? Your grandmother.
Grimmy, that's right.
One side of your family goes back like five generations in Los Angeles, and your grandfather, this is Grimmy's husband, Neil S. McCarthy.
Correct.
Was a big-time entertainment lawyer, right? For people like Howard Hughes and Cecil B. DeMille and Katharine Hepburn. Tell us a little bit about him.
He was formidable. He was a poor, poor boy from Phoenix, Arizona, and put himself through law school and became an entertainment lawyer. And when I expressed the desire to go into the entertainment field, he says, "You stay out of it. It's a filthy business."
Is it a filthy business? Do you agree with him?
Not for me. You know, I mean, I had a wonderful time, but I'm sure my grandfather saw a lot of dirt.
Do you remember as a kid hanging out with big stars like, you know, like Katharine Hepburn and Lana Turner and, you know, studio heads, Louis B. Mayer?
No, but I did have Lana Turner's mannequin. They used to do my clothes at Universal Studios on her old mannequin. I said, I can't believe I ever had Lana Turner's body, but hey, I'll take it.
And you had some body issues, right? Like that you
yes.
had trouble with over the years. You always thought you were overweight and that other people were judging you for that. Where did that come from?
My grandmother was just very strict, and no women in our family were heavy. And she finally locked me up once when I was a freshman in college, locked me up at her house and took 40 pounds off of me.
How was that for you? My gosh.
It was kind of cool. I was being presented to an organization, I don't know if it still exists, called Las Madrinas, and beneficiaries of that charity are Children's Hospital. But anyway, we were debutantes. And my grandmother said, "I'll be damned if you're going to walk out there looking like Moby Dick." So,
wow.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I loved her very much. She was formidable. But she, you know, lack of control, just something she didn't understand.
I want you to read the last lines of your introduction, because I think it really gets to the heart of who you are. Yeah, this is the book that features a picture of you at Beverly Jackson Jill's summertime day camp in the Valley.
That's right.
Tell us about the picture, right? The picture first. What do you look like in that picture? And then read the last paragraph of your introduction.
All right. The picture is of me, I guess around eight, I think. Yeah, 8 years old. And my hair is just all sort of trashed and baggy shorts and my bluebird blouse on with chocolate all down the front and chocolate on my face. And I tell you, I'm the happiest kid I've ever seen. And so it was taken to me at summer camp, day camp. And so I'm describing this child who's so happy and a mess, kind of. And I write, "Yet rarely is anything left to its own devices, not even cherished photographs. A couple of years ago, I took my small camp photo to be enlarged and framed. It now hangs in the entryway of my Studio City home. The photo editor, trying to correct what was wrong with me, airbrushed out all the chocolate stains on my blouse and on my face. Apparently, there are still many things about me that others think need fixing. I'm 78 years old now. Fuck 'em."
You talk about your need to perform. Did you always have a dream to be a performer? How instrumental was your family in that dream? Did they encourage you?
No. My grandfather, as I said, "It's a filthy business. Stay out of it." And you know Los Angeles. I'm from Hancock Park. And in that day and age, I lived in my grandmother's house. At least with my family, acting was sort of looked down upon. In fact, in Hancock Park, actors were not allowed to buy property.
Wow.
Yeah. However, there was one famous person that he did allow to buy property. He was four doors down from me, and that was Nat King Cole.
Wow.
And the only thing they made Nat do was sign an agreement that he would not have any wild parties. So anyway, at age 26, I admitted that I wanted to be an actress. I worked on the other side of the camera for years as a production assistant, a production secretary. So I knew the business very well, but never on the other side of the camera. And then I finally admitted it's what I wanted. So I went to acting school for like a year, and I was in a little play out in Encino, this senior center. Everybody had to sit on folding chairs, and we didn't charge anybody. It only ran two nights. Wasn't very good, but there was a man from Universal in the audience, and I made a terrible mistake on stage and missed my cue and came running out trying to pull my costume together half nude. It looked like I'd gotten laid behind the curtain, and the audience went crazy. They started laughing. They thought it was intentional and that I was a brilliant comedian. And I got a call at my office from a man who was head of publicity at Universal, saying he had seen me in my play. He said, "You're perfect for the lead in John Cassavetes' new film. And I would like you to meet Monique James, the head of our talent department."
Wow.
Everybody knew who Monique James was. Every actor in town did. And I said, "Okay, cut the bullshit. Who is this?" He said, "Well, I can understand you're being skeptical. Why don't I have Miss James call you?" I said, "Do that." I thought it was someone from my acting class. And damn, if she didn't call me and asked me to come in, and we met, and she said, "I want you to prepare a scene for me." And I waited like 5 months to work on my scene. She called me back. She said, "Are you ever bringing that scene in?" So I did. And she signed me that night.
Wow.
To a 7-year contract.
So, and you were one of the last actors to be put under contract, right? By studio, in your case, Universal.
Yes. I don't know if I was the last contract there to be signed, but I was the last one to leave the lot. I was there 10 years.
What was your first real speaking role on a TV show? Where did that come from?
I think the first speaking role I had, excuse me, may have been Marcus Welby. Huh. Then I ended up being on his series, Marcus Welby, for a year. But I was miscast, and I wasn't very good in it, so I got fired.
I want to play a clip from Cagney and Lacey. Gosh, this is from the late 1980s, and this is your character, Christine Cagney, dealing with the demons of the bottle.
Or I can get up by myself.
Oh, come on.
Oh, wow, you...
Oh, sorry.
You got me all wet.
I didn't realize that you...
It's my good blouse, too, and I'm drenched. I'll probably get the flu. I smell like a brewery.
It's okay, Chris.
Really?
It's all right.
That's like, wow. I mean, I remember seeing this on the show in real time and how convincing you were dealing with alcoholism. How was life going for you around that time personally? Because I read somewhere you were drinking your own apple juice on the set. Is that what was going on?
Yes. Well, no. I mean, I drink it when we wrapped.
Yeah.
I never drank when I worked because I always thought it threw my timing off. I didn't think I was that good, you know. But the cocktail hour in my life is revered. My parents all drank, my family drank, and I drank too. And my agent, who had been my agent for many years, took exception to that and took me to dinner. And I said, "I know why you've taken me to dinner, because you think I'm getting fat." He said, "No, actually, you look great. That isn't why I'm taking you to dinner. I'm taking you to dinner because I think you're an alcoholic."
Oh.
I said, "How dare you?" I said, "Ronnie, I've known you for years. We have drinks together all the time." He said, "I know, but it's different for you now." And he had let the waiter, he'd asked the waiter apparently not to remove any of my martini glasses, even though he brought another one. And I looked down, there were four empty sitting there.
Yeah.
And, anyway, I got very upset, and I said, "You know, just stop. People are listening. I want to talk that you're wrong, and stop it." He said, "Let them listen." He said, "I may lose you as a client. I may lose you as a friend, but I don't want to lose you." So he said, "When do you finish Cagney and Lacey?" I remember this so well. He said, "April 13th. He said, "Well, you're going to be in Betty Ford on the 14th, or I'm doing an intervention on you."
Wow.
Yeah.
So your agent, and then your pancreas, right? told you to stop drinking.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, I did quit drinking for 15 years. And then I thought, oh, I'm okay. I can. So I took it up again for a few years. And then I had a pancreatic attack. And the doctor said, if you ever have another drink again, don't call me because I don't do suicide.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah. You know?
So anyway, I was afraid of having another attack. So I quit drinking and I haven't had another drink since. I still have the pancreatic attacks, but not for booze, but I'm not about to test it.
Yeah. You found love though on the set of Cagney and Lacey, didn't you?
I did. I fell in love with my producer. It was sad because he was married. So, we didn't become attracted to each other till the fifth year of the series. I couldn't stand him when I met him. Couldn't stand him. I thought he was so arrogant. But he was the best producer I'd ever worked for. And became a good friend and then got more serious. It was very painful at the time. But now we've been married 30 years.
Wow. Your dad loved doing Christmas in a big way.
Yes.
Something in your book that you say he did to connect with your grandfather, right? His father-in-law.
Right.
What do you remember about those days? And do you have any traditions that you are keeping into this day?
Well, now I live in Florida. So instead of having a Christmas tree, now we have a big palm tree that's all lit up in our house.
Is it a real palm tree?
No.
It's a
you take it out of the box and you fluff it up. But it looks sensational. So we do the season, honors. Just do it a little differently. We do it the Florida way. But my father, his Christmas tree was the first colored photo ever to appear in the Los Angeles Times.
Wow.
And it was on the cover of Society section, whatever that section was in those days. And it was quite sensational. And my mom, in response to it, would buy little baby trees, real ones, for the three of us, the three children. We'd get to have the lights on it until we fell asleep. Then she'd come and unplug all of them. You know? I loved Christmas at our house. It was really very nice. We were very fortunate.
We love having you on our show right before Christmas, and I want to thank you for your time.
Steve, thank you. Sorry if I talked too much.
No, I loved it. It was amazing. We can cut what we don't need, but Sharon Gless, author of the new memoir, apparently there were complaints. Sharon, thank you for coming on, and happy holidays. Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, Steve, and happy holidays, and to all your listeners.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, LA keeps looking for ways to get the unhoused off the streets, but one homeless site for safe parking and camping is only half full and unpopular among the unhoused. Why? And now it's shutting down. That's tomorrow on a new episode of GLA. Subscribe to the podcast, by the way, kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us how you're doing at kcrw.com/GLA. And also, we talked about coyotes at the top of the show. What are you doing about coyotes? Are you afraid of them? Would you like to know more about them? KCRW.com/ask. Greater LA. And grab the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, won't you? Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sudley, Crystal Goss, Sonia Guys, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on today's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears and for your time. Have a great night.